Hello, everyone. Welcome to Off and Running. I'm your host, Danny Choka. Thank you for listening in, and we're off and running. Hey there, everyone. I'm going to start reducing these podcasts to about 15, 20 minutes. It's mainly the producing time of trying to produce a show for 30 minutes to 40 minutes. That's also a very time-consuming process. Just give you a couple of nuggets here and there of what's going on and what are the most relevant stories currently happening in sports. And then I'm also going to tack on a couple of fantasy team update with fantasy football. I'm going to roll around here in a couple months, and a lot of people start doing their drafts, you know, at the beginning of August. So every week I'll give you a couple of teams and kind of their main players and some of their main potential players that could be a sleeper for you, and you might be able to pick up in the later rounds that could make the difference for you and your fantasy football team coming up this year. But first, let's talk about the NBA Finals. And I had the Warriors in five games in the NBA Finals. I figured Cleveland would win game three. So we've had two games now in the books, and Golden State has dominated both of those games, winning easily by 20 points or more. Before the series started, I thought Golden State would be the hungrier team because they have Durant. With Durant not winning a title yet, he's kind of the only one out of the whole team besides some of the veterans that joined on for cheap, like McGee and West, that haven't won an NBA title. And so he's going to be the hungriest out of all the star players, and he's playing like it. Obviously, he's their best player, and he's definitely shown it in the playoffs. The rest of the Warriors team also wants to revenge the fluke win for Cleveland last year in the championship, which, by the disparity in talent, definitely has determined that last year's win by Cleveland is very fortunate for Cleveland and Cleveland fans. As I've already gone through this multiple times, a lot of things had to go Cleveland's way for them to win the title last year. Steve Kerr returned to the bench in Game 2, but I thought before the series it was irrelevant if he came back or not. Mike Brown's done a great job with that team, and Steve Kerr's also been traveling with the team, and he's been in their locker room at halftime with all of their home games and giving them a few pointers here and there, like they did with Game 1 of the San Antonio series, talking about some adjustments for them at halftime. When the Warriors won the Western Conference Finals, it was the most ho-hum, here-we-go-again, quietest Western Conference Finals celebration I'd ever seen from an NBA team. Even those Laker teams that went back-to-back-to-back, they even had a decent amount of celebrating before they got to the finals. Probably because once they knew they won the Western Conference, I was basically deciding who was going to win the NBA championship because the East was such a lower caliber, just like now with Cleveland and the rest of the Eastern Conference. In the series, the decreased competition of the Eastern Conference is really showing for Cleveland. Before the series started, I thought Cleveland's perimeter defense was going to be a huge liability for them going up against Golden State's offense. Cleveland could do a lot of correcting by just stopping the ball and everybody just covering a man that comes down the floor. You know, basic defense that you learn in elementary school that Cleveland doesn't seem to want to do between Kyrie Irving and J.R. Smith. I think that's why Iman Shumpert got more playing time in Game 2, just to have somebody out there that actually knows how to play basic defense with staying between his man and the basket. The only way for Cleveland to even win a game or even make it a series is they'd have to have their three-point shooters shoot better than the Golden State Warriors. Most people believed that Cleveland's opportunity in this series was going to be their ability to play more physical. Golden State has shown to be the team to come out and play more physically, and they're ready for the finals and how the finals is refereed after learning their lesson from last year. Cleveland shooters like Deron Williams, Kyle Korver, J.R. Smith, and Channing Frye are actually struggling with the physicality and the defense of Golden State, and they're unable to get open. I'm kind of surprised that Cleveland hasn't decided to go after Curry like they did last year. Obviously, he's one of their weaker defenders on defense, and so I'm kind of surprised that they haven't tried to take the person who Curry's guarding and have them run screen and roll, even if it's Kyle Korver, have that person, whoever's guarding Curry, come up, set the screen for either Kyrie or LeBron, and then make Curry make the decision. Is he going to switch? And if he doesn't switch, then let LeBron and Kyrie take advantage of those extra steps to try to get to the basket and get easy hoops. For me, I see the Warriors only sticking together next year. As I mentioned, with the salary cap increase, Curry's going to have to raise his salary for next year from $12 million probably to around $20 million. And then Kevin Durant's going to have to bring his down from $27 million to around $20 million. And then Draymond and Klay Thompson, they're locked up next year already for $17 and $18 million respectively. So having the four superstars around $20 million is going to help the Golden State Warriors keep their team together. And I don't really see them losing as long as they stay together and intact. I could see them being the LeBron killer and basically eliminating the conversation between LeBron and Michael Jordan as they win the next three NBA Finals. Durant's 28 years old, so he's just getting into the prime of his career, and he definitely has a good 4 to 5 years of probably taking over LeBron for the best player in the NBA. The thing that surprised me the most about Kevin Durant is his ability even to guard Kyrie Irving when LeBron's out of the game and when Klay Thompson's out of the game for Golden State, who's been Kyrie Irving's primary defender. Kevin Durant's able to stick with him, and then his length really gives Kyrie problems when he tries to drive to the basket and finish. Kyrie's a great finisher around the basket, and Kevin Durant's length really seems to give him trouble to make his shot off just enough where he can't make it as often as he normally does against some of the other centers and guards from Golden State. It will definitely be interesting to see if LeBron and Cleveland try to reload with some other free agents and other players from the East to try to compete with Kevin Durant and this Golden State team in the West. There's rumblings if Chris Paul is going to go to the Spurs, and then I think the Spurs would have to add still another player like Paul George or Jimmy Butler to make the Spurs a legit contender against the Golden State Warriors. But this would only solidify the Western Conference Final being similar to the NBA Finals, where whoever won the West was going to end up winning the NBA Championship over the Eastern Conference winner. People are saying that the only reason why this Golden State team is put together is because of the rise of the salary cap and Kevin Durant being a free agent, and it was a perfect storm of all these circumstances. I completely disagree. The salary cap going up was the only reason why this team was put together, and it allowed four star players to come together and make at least $20 million a year. That's pretty much kind of the sweet spot. That's kind of the number. If players can make around $20 million a year, that's plenty of money for them, especially with the rest of their lifestyle not going up in value or not being inflated. Kobe's last 2 years, he made about $24 million a year, and he was the highest paid player at the time before the salary cap went up. And so players making this type of money has only made it easier for them to join together and form these super teams. And so I only see super teams being formed in the future, as I mentioned before, where you can't just have two star players, you have to have 3 to 4 star players to contend for an NBA title. All right, well, let's switch gears over to fantasy. I'm just going to give you guys a couple teams, give you their rundown, kind of some players to look out for, and then some of their top players, and kind of let you know if their draft position is legit and if the points that they give you in the regular season is worth drafting them at certain rounds. So we're going to go through Arizona and Seattle NL West teams. And I'm only going to stick to the most relevant teams. Like, I'm not going to cover some of the seller teams like the Rams or San Francisco unless we end up having enough time before the season starts. I'm only going to stick with mainly the top teams from each conference and the top offensive players. So for Arizona, their top player last year was David Johnson, their running back. He was the best running back last year, and I felt like he's the only one that really held his value as a first round pick as a running back. Obviously, Antonio Brown was the number one pick and he lived up to the billing. But as a running back, I think David Johnson was the only one. And the great thing about him that made him the most versatile was even if Arizona was behind and they weren't running the ball a lot, he was able to catch a lot of balls out of the backfield, and he had a lot of receiving touchdowns as well. So he had you covered in both sides of the ball, and they had him in there as a 3-down back. I expect him to be another first round pick, and I would have no hesitation with taking him with my first pick overall. Last year, he was around 9th or 10th at the end of the first round. I could see him being in the middle of the first round this year. Arizona's most consistent receiver, Larry Fitzgerald. It's going to be his last year before he retires, so he's definitely going to be trying to put up a bunch of stats to make his numbers look better for the Hall of Fame. I don't really trust Larry Fitzgerald. His consistency is kind of up and down. He's kind of a boom or bust. One game he'll give you like 2 touchdowns and over 100 yards, and then he'll go through like 3 games where he'll be around like 30, 40, 50, 60 yards receiving. So he's not really able to be trusted. Maybe as a wide receiver 3, you could put him in there, or maybe as a flex when he's has a good matchup against a team with not really that good of a secondary. Personally, I wouldn't draft Larry Fitzgerald until rounds 8 or 9 at the earliest. For Arizona, you can't really trust Palmer at quarterback. He was very inconsistent last year after having an amazing performance the 2 years ago. So you're not really sure what you're going to get out of Palmer, as well as the rest of the wide receivers for Arizona. They're also boom or bust, like John Brown, Jared Brown, and Nelson. The only wide receiver that I could see stepping up this year and kind of improving and increasing his value would be J.J. Nelson. He's kind of a big play player, so he could get you, you know, 3 catches for 70 plus yards and a touchdown pretty consistently, where he only needs that one play to really break one for a long touchdown. And then for Arizona, the other player or players for their team is their team defense and special teams. One of the advantages of playing in the NFC West, where you get to play San Francisco twice and the Rams twice, and Arizona always seems to play Seattle tough. Seattle seems to struggle on offense against Arizona, probably just with the divisional familiarity. Arizona also gets Houston, and who knows what's going to happen with their offense with Deshaun Watson down the stretch. And then they also get to play against the Washington Redskins. As you guys know, I have them definitely not making their win projection and really struggling this year with Cousins not having many weapons. And I think by the end of the season, Washington will be well out of it. So they'll be looking for the future, and they probably won't be giving Cousins nearly as many reps as they normally would. For Arizona's defense, I'd probably rank them in the top 8. Either 8 to 10 defenses in the league. And my draft advice is that you usually only pick a defense maybe your third to last round, or maybe even second to last round. I'm a big proponent of streaming defenses week to week instead of trying to take, you know, like an 11th or 12th round pick on like a top defense like Seattle or Carolina. For me, I just like to look at the matchups, and I kind of look at it from a betting perspective on when teams are going to kind of rise up and have a really good week, and when teams are going to maybe lay an egg. And so I'll play a defense against a team where they might be coming off like a big divisional win and then they travel cross country, and then I'll play that opposing team's defense against them just on a week-to-week basis. And then that allows you to draft more of your bench and have a lot better depth on your bench and take a few more sleepers, kind of boom or bust players, instead of taking a defense in the 12th, 13th round. The other team we're going to talk about is Seattle. Their top player last year was Doug Baldwin, wide receiver. He's kind of Russell Wilson's go-to wide receiver. He's really broken out over the last 2 years after kind of coming along slowly, but now he's definitely a top 15 receiver, and he's putting up consistent numbers to validate him being drafted in the first probably 2 or 3 rounds, maybe late second round, early third. Thomas Rawls, their running back, could end up being their top fantasy player this year if he bounces back and stays healthy. It's coming off that ankle injury. But since Seattle signed Eddie Lacy, he might be taking away some of those goal line touches for Rawls, and so Lacy could be eating away at Rawls' fantasy value overall. I don't like to draft running backs that are just between the 20s type runners. I like the ones that actually are between the 20s and they get the goal line carries most of the time. Russell Wilson, a lot of people think he's a top 10 fantasy quarterback, and I definitely disagree. And that has to do with him not rushing nearly as much as he did in his first 2 to 3 years in the league. They're trying to keep him more in the pocket to keep him safer so he doesn't get hurt, because he's really their only quality quarterback on their roster. Russell Wilson also hasn't developed that connection with Jimmy Graham like the way Drew Brees did with all those red zone touchdowns and all those jump ball touchdowns. Jimmy Graham could be a sleeper at tight end. He could definitely be a top 10 tight end, even better than Delanie Walker from Tennessee, Cincinnati's Eifert, and then Tampa Bay's O.J. Howard. He's 2 years removed from his patellar tendon injury, and then he's had another year to build more rapport with Russell Wilson, so maybe this year they'll be able to click. As I mentioned, he just needs more of those end zone jump balls, and that'll really boost his value moving forward. Of course, with the patellar tendon injury, a lot of players have to end up retiring after suffering that type of injury, so maybe Jimmy Graham has just lost a few steps after rehabbing from the injury, and this is just his normal speed going forward, where he's not as explosive, and he's not able to get that spring in his step that he did down in New Orleans. And then Seattle's probably top player, if you want to say, is their defense. And similar to Arizona, they get San Francisco and the Rams twice. And then they get Houston and Washington early. So Houston, if they haven't really figured out their quarterback position early, or Watson has kind of some growing pains, Seattle could really feast off that matchup. A lot of people draft Seattle defense, like I mentioned, in the 11th, 12th, 13th round, somewhere around there. Kind of one of the first defenses off the board. They're definitely warranted with that draft pick, especially with their home field advantage. The question comes down to, with their core players of Sherman, Chancellor, Michael Bennett, Earl Thomas, KJ Wright, and Wagner, is their core aged enough where they might be on the downslide, where they might have peaked, and now they're going to come back to kind of normal? And then with, obviously, how potent the offenses are in this league, throwing the ball, will that expose them? When this defense was at their best, they were getting a lot of turnovers, and they were scoring a lot of points off those turnovers to help Russell Wilson in the offense. I think this is Seattle's last chance to win the NFC, to win a Super Bowl, with the players that they have, and then I think after this season, they're going to have to break up their team based on paying certain players. And I think once you have a core group of guys for more than 5 years, everybody starts to kind of wander off and break up if you're not winning titles. And I think that's what Seattle's going to face with their defense in the next couple of years. There was one other topic that I wanted to get to this week just because it's relevant time-wise, and that's Albert Pujols reaching 600 home runs, which has really gotten no fanfare and nobody's paid any attention to at all after the way that Bonds, Sosa, and Maguire got all this attention for hitting home runs 10 years ago. Pujols is signed until 2021, and his contract actually goes up every year. He's at $24 million right now, and by the time he retires in 4 years, he's going to be making $30 million a year. Obviously, this was the big contract that Artie Moreno signed him to, which the Cardinals knew was going to be a terrible contract and wouldn't yield any real production for the value that he's being paid. So right now, the Anaheim Angels, they have two players that are tying up their entire salary cap over the next 5 years, as Pujols and Trout are going to be the highest paid players on their team moving forward. Now for me, I don't count the egregious steroid abusers like Bonds, A-Rod, Sosa, and Maguire to the all-time home run list. So right now, Pujols has a chance to really jump up. He's currently sixth on my list behind Aaron, Ruth, Mays, Ken Griffey, and Jim Thome. I don't think many people realize that Ken Griffey and Jim Thome were up there on that list. Pujols has been averaging around 25 to 30 home runs the last 3 or 4 years. So I think if you conservatively estimate that he's going to get 25 the next 2 years each, and then he's going to get 15 to 20 his last 2 years as a DH, obviously, then that would put him roughly third all-time behind Babe Ruth and just ahead of Willie Mays. He'll be around like 665, 675, something like that. And Mays is at 660. So Pujols would be third all-time. I don't think a home run hitter of his caliber will get less attention than has ever been seen before for the amount of home runs over his illustrious career. Another factor that plays into Pujols not getting much attention, is obviously playing on the West Coast with the Angels. Nobody watches the West Coast teams in the East, and all of the sporting networks are in the East. So there's really no love or attention given toward West Coast teams. But Albert Pujols, congratulations on hitting number 600. He joins a very elite club in the Major League Baseball ranks of all time. Thank you for listening. Off and Running is available in iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow our Twitter feed at off_running.